Shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The talk of the town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Bedtime turns me off and I don't need maybe. 9 to 5 ain't taking me where I'm bound.
Welcome to Nocturnal Journal, and what a show we have for you tonight. From 10 to 11, we've got John Langford and Sally Timms from the Mekons going to play some music and talk about their latest record. 9:30 to 10, we're going to have our friends from Fitzgerald's in Berwyn, Bill and Kate and Donnie Biggins are going to handicap this year's American Music Festival over the 4th of July weekend. And in the studio, our leadoff men, we have our good friend Stan Klein. The director?
Yes, director works.
Of Firecat Projects, 2124 North Damon Avenue, and you brought in movie producer and now artist Bill Horberg.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, you got a great radio voice. That's good. That's good. So, boy, there's so much to talk about in this half hour, but talk about your roots in Chicago, Bill. I'm going to start with the Sandberg Theater and your family. I know Marguerite, your sister. Talk about what it was like growing up. There must have been a lot of creative stuff going around.
Yeah. My sister really led the way. You know, she's founded the Hot House here and ran that organization for 25 years. And, you know, I got into playing music as a teenager in high school here.
What high school was
that?
I
had a band. I went to the Latin school.
Okay.
And I actually went on to study music at the Berklee College of Music in Boston.
What'd you play?
I play the flute and the piano.
Oh, really? Little Herbie Mann type stuff.
Yeah, Eric Dolphy was my god, yeah. And Herbie Mann. And, you know, I used to go to the Jazz Showcase growing up here, and Joe Siegel and all the great people that he brought in. But I left school in the late 70s, moved back home to Chicago. And because I'd been living in Boston, where there was such a rich scene of different theater venues that were showing classic movies and foreign films, and I was living with a guy who was running the Film Society at Tufts, and there wasn't anything quite like that at that time here. And I had this idea to open a movie theater. The Sandberg Theater had been shuttered. It had been the Playboy Theater.
We're going to talk about the comic book, and you brought back memories. I was at the Sandberg. I don't think I was there when it was the Playboy. But what was Playboy trying to do with that house?
You know, they went into film production in the 70s. They made a couple of movies, Polanski's Macbeth, and you know, they had a successful brand with the clubs, and they decided to try to extend that brand into motion picture exhibition. The theater still had the bunny logo carpeting on the floor when we took it over. But we were, you know, a horse of a different color. We were young film enthusiasts, and we were showing Hitchcock and Truffaut and Werner Herzog, and Arthur Penn came and, you know, did live programs at the theater. So that was kind of my road into Hollywood, really. I didn't go to film school. I didn't study film, but I just jumped into exhibition at a young age. And when the theater closed, I ultimately set sail and moved out to Los Angeles in the mid-80s.
Before we leave the theater, it was in the Gold Coast. Do you remember the address? The Clark Street.
It was 1210 Dearborn.
Dearborn, okay.
Yeah, I think it's still a Walgreens.
Yes, it's still a Walgreens.
And just a little bit of ironic history, Dave. You know, we had probably for a couple of years shown some of the great Cary Grant movies, Charade, Only Angels Have Wings. And I remember when it was torn down and rebuilt, Cary Grant himself was a friend of Betty Walgreen, and he came and dedicated the opening of that Walgreens on the ashes of our revival movie theater.
Well, that's great.
But, you know, Bill did really specialty things. He did like a 24-hour jazz festival, movies, and live act, because it had a small stage, and he would do all sorts of long programs.
What was that neighborhood like? When did it close?
At that time, it was like looking for Mr. Goodbar Land, right? It was Mothers and Rush Street, and it was like a raging disco scene. And then, you know, you could walk across the street and watch the Philadelphia Story. The theater was taken over after we left, but it only lasted about another year. I think it was probably 83 or 84 where it was torn down and redeveloped.
So you go out west. You go to Hollywood?
Go west, young man.
Yeah, and what happens there?
Yeah, I got off the plane. I thought I had a job. Somebody had promised me a job, and like a lot of things in Hollywood, it was more facade than real. And I ended up going to work as a freelance script reader. So that was kind of my undergrad. I had to read 1,000 scripts. I got paid $35 a script. I had to do my book report, synopsize the story, and write some analysis on it. And I worked for a number of companies at that time, like the RKOs and the De Laurentiis and Interscope. And I couldn't get a job at a big studio because that was all union work. But this was freelance work, and it really got me a chance to kind of know who's who in the zoo, get my head around, you know, what people are reading and what they're looking for and what's getting made. And from there, I really stumbled into a lucky chance, and I got a job as a junior executive at Paramount Pictures. This was in 1987. It was the era of Eddie Murphy, of John Hughes, of Simpson Bruckheimer, the first time I ever actually sat in a theater and watched what they have these audience test screenings was the very first screening of Fatal Attraction, which famously had a kind of beautifully made but narratively flawed ending that the audience just totally rejected. So I had a front row seat at like high stakes studio filmmaking drama. You know, I was at the studio for about 5 years, Dave. I got to work with Francis Ford Coppola, with Mike Nichols, with the Zucker Brothers, Hunt for Red October, Ghost. That was really a tremendous grad school for me.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Then we're going to segue into what you're doing now.
Yeah.
I got so many questions. So don't go away.
Hey, Daddy, what that there? And why that under there? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, Daddy, hey, look it over there. Hey, what they doing there? And where they going there? And Daddy, can I have that big elephant over there? Hey, who that in my chair? And what she doing there? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, Daddy, can I go over there?
Oscar Brown Jr. Wow. We love Oscar Brown Jr. He was... Did you ever meet him?
I never got to meet him. Man, yeah. I wish I did.
Voice of Bronzeville, you know. Yeah. So I don't want to get in the way. So I'm going to fast forward to get why we're doing this. So you have a heart attack.
Jump right in there.
Yeah.
So what happened? Yeah, I produced films for about 30 years. Yeah. It's a bit of a stressful job, as you can imagine. I always wanted an outlet, and I played music and continued to play my music kind of in the park on the weekends. And about 4 years ago, I was over in Spain. I was producing probably one of the largest projects I've ever undertaken. It was called The Promise. It was this big epic film about the Armenian genocide, Christian Bale, Oscar Isaac. And there was a knock on the door. It was the ambulance. And I ended up in the hospital in Madrid for about a month. I had a lot of time on my hand. I had a Moleskine notebook and a pencil, and I just started sketching. And I was like, who do I want to bring into this room with me at this point in time? And it was just all these musicians that I'd grown up studying and listening to and loving. And I started doing sketches of them and filled up a notebook and got another one and filled that one up and came home. And I just kind of took over and became a bit of an obsession with me.
Art Pepper, you got the Velvet Lounge. Is that's Fred?
Fred Anderson, a great old friend. I got to spend a lot of time at his place on Indiana, South Indiana, when I was here.
I believe Oscar's in here. That's why
Oscar's on the cover.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there he is.
He's on the cover of the catalog. Yeah, Eric Dolphy and Roland Kirk and
Alice Coltrane. That's nice.
Yeah. And Ornette Coleman and all these people I got to, many of whom I got to see live and hear play. And so my old friend Stan Klein invited me to bring this collection of drawings to the Firecat Projects, and it was a chance for a homecoming for me. And it was a great night last night. We had a packed house at the opening, and you know, you're in the room, and I like to ask people to just listen to the drawings, because you know, you can watch them and you can really, I hope, kind of hear the vibrations coming off the wall.
I want to talk about tomorrow in a minute, but Firecat Projects is at 2124 North Damon Avenue. The show is up through August 25th, 2019. Stan, talk about, and it's in the catalog, but talk about his work. Describe his work from your point of view.
He brings that sensibility of somebody that plays jazz to the work. There's a certain taste level of what to include and what not to include. It doesn't do too much, and it really brings the simplicity and the emotion of that person who's the subject to fair.
Now, what will happen tomorrow? You're going to be doing a reading from 2 to 4 o'clock. Tell the listeners what happens tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow afternoon I'll be over at the gallery. I have written a book along with my films and my artwork. It's a book of stories, mostly of different films and, you know, the characters I've met along the way producing all these films in Hollywood. And I'm going to give a reading of a couple of stories from the book. The book is called My Life in Space, Stories of a Hollywood Outlier.
And so you'll be reading from that?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to pick a couple of stories to read and, you know, in the gallery surrounded by the artwork. And so hopefully it'll be a kind of trifecta of the things that I'm super passionate about, you know, which is film and art and music.
Are there similarities between, I don't want to call it visual jazz, but what are the similarities between music and jazz? I mean, movies and jazz.
Well, I study music in Woodstock now. I moved from Hollywood about 4 years ago, and the mantra for me is to kind of play from listening.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of try to bring that approach to the movies I make. You know, what is this really about, and what is the thing telling me, and what's the story that needs to be told, and how do we shape it? And I try to bring that same sensibility to improvised solo, and it was certainly my approach, you know, creating this artwork. I would do a deep dive, listening to the catalog of a certain artist and do a lot of research on their life.
Did you listen to them while you were
sketching while I was
them?
Drawing them? I would kind of put the headphones on and have a playlist and listen through and just try to, in my own way, take whatever I was feeling from that and express those feelings through the end of a pen.
Stan.
Yeah, it's in some ways it's that being in the moment of listening and playing, and also for an artist, a visual artist, it's seeing and observing and then processing that out. And he has that talent.
Did you see Shortcuts?
The Robert Altman movie?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Sure. I wrote about that when it came out, and that was a movie that really had a jazz feel to it. And I brought some of these notes in that you know, based on the Raymond Carver short stories, but Altman wrote, I think it was in the soundtrack, in the notes of the soundtrack, it was, he's talking about maybe they just have to go on knowing things that they don't really want to know about one another. They're more about what you know rather than what you don't know. He's talking about the characters, and the reader fills in the gaps while recognizing the undercurrents. It's kind of like a jazz thing.
Yeah, well, Altman was the master of kind of improvisation on film, you know, and he came out of Kansas City, right?
Uh-huh, right.
So he had a real jazz background. I think he even made a movie in the 50s that was a jazz-themed movie. Yeah, I got to meet him once. You know, I worked for about 12 years for Sidney Pollack. And through Sidney, I got to meet some of his filmmaking peers, and we hung out for a night in Cannes with Robert Altman, and that was a real treat.
And when you think of what Bill does, and he produced Talented Mr. Ripley, and it has that jazz element very live in that plot line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Anthony Minghella, I was lucky to make two films with him, Cold Mountain and Ripley. And in some ways, they were musical films. They weren't musicals, but he was a guy who started with music when he wrote. He didn't apply music at the end as somebody scoring a film that's been edited. He had the composer in with him when he was writing the script.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so his whole approach to filmmaking had the music really baked into it. And I think that's why we were so simpatico as producer and director collaborating with each other.
You talk to other Hollywood people about jazz? Clint Eastwood?
I never got to meet Clint. I'd love to. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, there's a bit of an overlap, but not that much.
What will people see when they come to the guy? How many pieces are up? Describe what people see when they come visit you.
There are several small sort of portraits, about, say, 6x8, really beautifully intricate, delicate portraits. And then he's also done large venue images of, like, Mr. Kelly's and London House,
yeah.
You know, and they're just, it's his level of what he includes and the color, it just evokes that
I wanted
feeling.
To do something real Chicago, right?
Yeah.
So the new work in the show are these six pieces that I did kind of out of my love of growing up in Chicago.
Is that
the London House, and this was Mr. Kelly's, and the Velvet Lounge is in there.
Look at the Rush Up and the Happy Medium. I mean, very colorful.
Yeah. And the Jazz Showcase was downstairs there from the Happy Medium for several years. You know, that was one of their venues here.
Some people might say jazz is a noir, black and white. Why'd you go with so many colors?
Well, those are color portraits, but there are some black and white in the show. Yeah. There's three groups of black and white portraits as well, so which I really enjoy, just kind of getting it down to the line and the simplicity of the line, and that's all you have. You don't have a color palette to add to that. So what you'll see is a lot of individual portraits of jazz musicians that are grouped together in large groupings. So I have one called 50 Musicians. It's quite a large piece where there are 50 portraits of jazz musicians kind of framed together in one piece as a big family that you just kind of want to hang out with and imagine the conversations that are going on between them musically and also without their instruments.
Are you still involved? A couple more minutes, we got. Are you still involved in the industry?
Very much so, yeah. Mm-hmm. This has turned into one of my busiest years. I was trying to just make art and play music, but just got back from Winnipeg, Dave. We're shooting a film there right now called Flag Day. It's a project I've been laboring to get on the screen for more than a decade, and Sean Penn is directing. He's starring in it with his daughter, Dylan Penn, who's an amazing actress and is going to be a revelation for the audience. And it's a father-daughter story, a true story. So to have a real father and daughter playing these father-daughter characters, there's just a frisson that, you know, that comes with that is really exciting.
Last thing, and then so the reason I asked that question is, once you started sketching and once you got involved in this and the artwork, did your view toward other things, the industry and stuff, did that change at all? Did this change your the lens in which you look at things?
Well, I think it just brought more balance and harmony to my life overall.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, I was so in the tunnel of filmmaking for about 30 years, and I'm happily still kind of plying that craft, but I have these other areas in which to have an outlet and express myself creatively. And, you know, drawing is a very individual, personal, alone act. Making a movie involves hundreds, if not thousands, of people that you're orchestrating through a process that can take 18 months or 2 years. So I like the polarity of my life right now and having these other places to go.
Fascinating. Wow, that was great.
Thanks, a great
interview.
Thanks for
Stan.
Thank you, Dave.
It's Portraits in Jazz by William Horberg, and it runs through August 25th at Firecat Projects, 2124 North Damon Avenue, and there's an artist reading tomorrow between 2 and 4.
Hope to see you there.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot. And we'll be back after more Nocturnal Journal.
Plastic silver 9-volt heart. Click it on and let the music start.
The Iguanas. That's all you need to know. They close out the festival on July 6th. In the studio, we have Bill and Kate Fitzgerald of Fitzgerald's, owners of the beloved Fitzgerald's nightclub in Berwyn, and talent buyer Donnie Biggins. Thank you all for coming down here tonight.
Thank you. Hey, Dave.
We're among friends and stuff. So let's talk about, again, we never know who's listening to the show, maybe for the first time out. Tell people the roots of the festival, a little bit of the Festival 101, the history of the festival. This is number 38.
38th festival, and I think our 39th celebration. We've been, you know, Fitzgerald's opened in 1980, so we had our first celebrated the first time in 1981, but the first full-fledged festival was that following year after having gone to the Jazz and Heritage Festival, and it just, you know, it made me pick up on a lot of ideas I've always had about small-town festivals and 4th of July and all that business. So we decided let's do a one-day July 4th deal. And we had four bands. I think I remember it was the Famous Potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
And the Chicago Salty Dogs, which had a history of playing in that building.
And they're still they're opening going. The festival they're, on July 3rd.
Yeah. There's that name's still going. Some of the members are still at it. And then we had the Jazz Members Big Band, who was our house big band at the time, and we rounded it out with our big discovery of from New Orleans, Clifton Chenier, and the Red Hot Louisiana Band. So it was a perfect start, you know, but one day and four acts.
And how's it changed over the years for everybody? In terms of, I was thinking about this, in terms of music styles, in terms of audience, just how it's evolved over 38 years.
Well, I mean, going from four to, what are we up to, 60? Who's counting?
Almost,
right? 60 plus.
Almost like 70.
60 plus bands.
Yeah, 60 plus bands this year?
Yeah. I mean, it sort of has that kind of wacky over the top fireworks show kind of deal. A little too much of everything. You know, like a garbage can full of fireworks and throw in the match and boom. You know, it's like pretty crazy.
Well, it's changed and it hasn't changed because there's a lot more bands, but it's still all on our property. We're all still there. We pretty much do everything the same way every year. We're not scanning any, you know, wristbands. We don't have a VIP tent. We're not sponsored by, you know, AT&T. So
yeah,
it's the same, just more music.
It's very homespun.
Very homespun.
Yeah. Tom Sims
still grills the brats and the andouille sausage and makes the you know, prepares a lot of the food like weeks in advance and then freezes, you know, like the cochon de lait.
The Monica.
And he does the jambalaya and the gumbo. Well, he does the gumbo ahead, but the jambalaya is cooked fresh. And that's a family affair. I mean, that's a story in itself. And one of these days we'll have to make a little video of what he does to prepare for that. But and I was thinking today, like, we use the same microphones. It's a Shure 58 is still the vocal mic after all these years. So.
It opens this year on Wednesday, July 3rd, and it runs through July 6th. Donnie, I mean, I go to the Jazz Fest a lot in New Orleans, and one thing, I mean, we talk about, I probably started going down there in 85, 86, and all those R&B guys I used to go see, like Lee Dorsey and Earl King and stuff, you know, they've passed on. I think some of them maybe, I don't know if you can count on the same stuff with this festival. In other words, how do you bring in new talent? What do you look for in bringing new people? Tell us some of the new talent people
can
expect.
Sure. So some of the newer acts that, you know, I kind of wanted to highlight. A repeated new act is Sarah Shook and the Disarmers, who has been a really growing alt country punk, that punk country vibe.
8:30 on Wednesday, July 3rd.
On July 3rd, yes.
In the tent.
And another new name here is The Suffers, and they are a great R&B soul funk band, big band. I think there's 8 or 9 members. They're going to be playing on the 5th, which is one of our shorter days, but I feel is just a stacked, you know, from door time to the end of the night. Every stage is really energetic and full of some big names for us.
And they're from Houston?
Yes.
Yeah,
and then another newer name to a lot of people that we kind of fell in love with last year was Blackfoot Gypsies,
right,
which are just kind of a modern Rolling Stones type of rock and roll energy, and they're closing out July 4th.
Yeah, at 11:15. With these newer acts, do they? I mean, the legacy acts, if you will, like Marsha Ball. She's July 6th at 8:30. Of course, they know about the club. They're familiar with the club. When you talk to newer acts, are they familiar with Fitzgerald's? Have they been through here before?
No, not all the time. It's just kind of part of my job to try to seek out this new talent that also fits the vibe of what Fitzgerald's is, and we just have to encourage our audience to trust that we know what we're doing and that it's going to be good.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you describe that vibe? All for everybody.
For
I mean, what, everybody here at the table.
Yeah. For me, growing up in Oak Park, you know, like it's nostalgic to walk into Fitzgerald still, and just the fact that I work there, I still like get excited, you know, when I'm coming to see a band there, because it's that special to me. But how would you describe the vibe?
The thing that happens to me every year is that here it is. And this year, especially since I'm sort of semi-retired, and I mean, I was working on the air conditioning all day today, and there's more to do. But it's a list of names on paper, and you know, a lot of these names you go, well, yeah, we know Alejandro, we know yeah. Terrence Simeon, but you know, it's just amazing when it actually starts. When you walk in the door, and things start rolling, it's an amazing thing how it develops. It's like a picture, and it's always a lot of fun, and it's just seeing a lot of old friends, and it's really the continuous music factor. It really pulls you along, and I love it. Can't wait.
I don't think there's any other place really like it, at least in the Midwest for us. You know, like. There's nowhere else you can go and get this amount of talent for the cost, you know. So
yeah, and we get that kind of feedback from the artists too. You know.
What are the different cover charges? Do you know off the top of your head? I've got cover charge $50 each day.
Yeah, yeah, that's just a straight $50, and then if you come in the first hour, you can get in for $40. And of course, if you're smart enough, buy a 4-day pass. It's like one free day. It's $150, and people can share that pass. You can give it to your friends if you're going one day, and they're going one day. And
that's only it says here, $150, only at TicketWeb.com?
Yeah, only online, okay, yeah. Right.
Kate, talk about the sidebar, and you take care of that. Talk about some of the acts in there. And describe I know you've put a lot of sense of history in that room, but talk about what the sidebar is and how you've booked that.
Well, Dave...
Well, I know one of our friends is playing there. She's been on the show. Christine Melody?
Yeah, Christine will be there. She is someone, a lot of these folks I came to know through our Tuesday open mic, which I've been attending, and most of them have been attending mm-hmm. every week for probably 25 years. So it's a little bit of a open mic all-stars. A lot of those people have a lot of talent. And a lot of them have gone on to better things, but they come back to play the sidebar. And then there's a few, I always leave room for people to drop in at the last minute, and I'm pretty pumped that we're going to have the Joel Patterson organ trio with Chris Foreman on the B3.
Oh, that's the first night.
Yeah, the very first night.
And we have a real B3 and a Leslie, so that's going to be quite an experience in that little bar.
Yep, yeah. I love... Curtis McMurtry, he came one year.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, of course, James's son, but he does his own thing. And the minute I saw him, I was like, you're coming back every year.
I wanted to buy James a drink, but he was kind of grumpy. He was sitting there.
he's a teddy bear. He's a doll baby.
Christine is what I have it at, what is she, 3:45?
Yeah.
On 3:45 p.m. We had her in the studio. She was great.
Yeah,
July
6th. Is great. She got up at open mic to sing, and then we were all just blown away.
Oh, God, she's fantastic. She's one of remember her? Christine Melody?
I do. Yeah. She was off the chain.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
great. It's just one of those things where everyone's chatting and talking, and then she started, and all of a sudden it got real quiet.
Yeah. She's really good. All right, we got to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk more about the greatest American music festival in the world at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn on WGN.
I keep reaching out to grab your hand, then pull you closer, baby.
Donnie, that's great.
Thank you.
Donnie Biggins, closer to you. Is that you? Is that your band?
Yes, that is my band.
Is that the record I saw at Val's Howe?
Yes. I released that in 2016.
It's great. It's like a little surf Mersey beat thing.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about your background in music. And you are playing with I don't know anything about this, the Shortcuts.
Yes,
is that your
we're
band?
Playing on July 4th.
July 4th mm-hmm. at 3 o'clock.
That's right. That's with Ryan Joseph Anderson, who's been a mainstay at the fest and the club for about 10 years. So,
and what kind of music is that?
It's just pretty straight rock and roll, a singer-songwriter with band type of rock and roll. It's a six-piece band with the B3. It's going to be up on stage. And
do you play Closer to You?
That I think that's going to be on the
set. Really? That song is so great.
Yeah.
So where I'm going with
that was my radio ready song.
Yeah,
that's why I sent that one.
It's perfect. It's great. So being a how long have you played? I don't know this.
I've been playing music for, I guess, 14 years.
And what all do you play? What instruments?
Guitar and piano and sing. Mostly try to find very good musicians to play with and then have them play my songs.
So how does that background, this is obviously where I'm going, how does that mm-hmm. background influence you as a talent booker when you're listening to music and stuff?
I think it helps me usually make good decisions in the artist's favor and also in the club. I'm kind of on both sides a lot. I understand the deals and what it takes to put on a good show and the efforts that, need to happen from both sides, from the promoter of the club and the artists themselves. That's kind of how I got into booking, was from booking my band, The Shams, in the city and with Bill at Fitzgerald's. So.
And you're involved with, last time you were on the show, we talked a little bit about that. You're involved with other clubs?
Yeah, I own a small room in Lincoln Park called Tonic Room, so we have live music there as well, and I handle all that booking.
And are you still doing Hey Nani?
No.
No? Yeah. Okay. All right. That was in Arlington Heights. So how many pieces are in the Shortcuts?
There are six of us. Yeah, so it's three guitars, B3, bass, and drums.
Capacity. What's the capacity of Fitzgerald? Legally.
Well, we...
The club?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 166.
166. Yeah. And the sidebar?
I think it's 53.
It's 53?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How have listening habits changed for people? I'm talking about, and everybody talks about this, people talking, people being on their cell phones and stuff, and how do you handle that?
The biggest problem for me personally is the cell phone situation where people are, toward the front of the crowd holding up their phones. I think that's probably, I don't think the listening habits have really changed that much. It's just, for some reason, people think it's more important to see the band through their screen than to just look. I don't know. I don't understand it. I don't know.
It's not. We occasionally have to remind people, turn off your camera light, you don't need it, and keep it low, keep it in front of your face, but it's not too bad.
Do artists ever have any rules, regulations? Or?
Not
once
that
in
often,
a while, an artist will call people out.
They will.
Yeah, just once in a while, just certain people.
So let's pick out a couple other acts. Tributosaurus becomes Bruce Springsteen. Tell the listeners who don't know anything about Tributosaurus who they are and what they'll be doing. And that is on the 4th. 10:15.
You want to know the members? I mean, it's Chris Neville is kind of the man behind Tributosaurus for the most part.
Yeah.
But they pick an artist, and it's always a big band, usually like 9 to 11 people, and they do a full tribute set. And Bruce Springsteen's one of their best ones that they often do, and we felt like, America kind of needs a Bruce Springsteen set at American Music Fest this year. And
it's
that's
great
what
show.
We wanted,
God, how long have they been at it now? They've got to have an anniversary coming up, but they just do a wonderful job.
Yeah. How many pieces will be there? Do they have, sometimes they have strings and stuff for Springsteen?
Yeah. I'm still waiting on that. Oh, Chris, okay. If you're listening, you can send me that
there's
info.
Always a couple of special guests outside the five-piece mm-hmm. core of the band, and then they'll probably have horn players and, of course, a saxophonist.
Of course.
Yeah. I think their thing is that they go the extra mile with the detail in doing these bands. If somebody has a triangle, they got a triangle. They really cover every detail.
Alejandro Escovedo on the last night, the 6th, 10:30. That's a club favorite.
Old friend of ours. Yeah, I'm anxious to see what he's got going this year. It's been a few years since we've seen him, so he's always great. You know. So.
We began the segment with the Iguanas. I'm so glad you brought them.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about them being from New Orleans.
Yeah, can't go wrong to finish up with them. Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, they are New Orleans. They really encapsulate that late night swampy sort of laid back, you know, vibe. I've never gone to Jazz Fest one time when I did not run into one of them out in the crowd.
For listeners who don't know them, I always kind of do a pedestrian description of them. They're kind of like maybe like a Los Lobos filtered through that whole New Orleans groove thing. You mm-hmm. know, they're fantastic. Zimmerman, same night as them. Talk about the Zimmerman.
Zimmerman is a Dylan tribute with like kind of the Roosevelt Road All-Stars. A lot of our club regulars, you know, it's a big band that Kathy Richardson plays with them. Ryan Anderson's going to be in with them.
And Terrence Simeon's going to sit in with them, too. He's going to do a song.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Pat Brennan on keyboards, he's sort of the heart of the band, I think, in some ways.
The major Dylan scholar.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, between songs, he'll tell you the minutia of...
Yeah, Terry White, our friend. Yeah. Chris Neville from Tributosaurus is part of this band. Mm-hmm. And they have the Zimmer Women the chorus of, you know, the three girls singing with
them.
Naomi,
Jenny, and...
you got
and
that.
Jody Walker. And let's not forget Clem Hayes and Grant Tye. Yeah. And
you guys from the same neck of the woods, I like to ask this question. How has the neighborhood changed in 38 years? Describe what Berwyn and Roosevelt Road was like when you started. What was
Bohemian.
There?
Bohemian.
Yeah, it was.
It was Czech and Bohemian, and it was very working class. Still is. The faces have changed. A lot more Hispanic families, still working class. Apparently, we also have quite a gay enclave, which is, of course, fantastic. And but it hasn't. We still have the same folks coming in. We might be doing a little bit more with Hispanic people when we do Beatles tribute bands. For some reason, they're a big draw for the Hispanic folks who live around us. Yeah.
Yeah, Wally Wilkes is gone, and you know, the empty lots down the street, of course, have mini malls and
I like to think that maybe I'm wrong, but I like to think that you gave birth to the whole entertainment scene there. There's a lot of entertainment options in terms of other clubs and in terms of restaurants and stuff. There's a lot more choices than there were.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if Outremont really needed us to open. That place is so, that's just beyond.
Yeah, but the little string of Fitzgerald's and the Friendly Tap and Wire is a nice thing. Nice little brewery on the Oak Park side.
Kinslager.
Kinslager and
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Well, we're going to have you hang around for our next guests, John Langford and Sally Timms. Oh, talk about the T-shirt this year. Langford did it.
Right now or when John gets there?
No, you can talk about that. We can bring it up again. There's no organization to all this.
I was thinking about artists this year, and I just, of course, love John's work. I mean, he's just, it's perfect artistry and music and Langford mix. And so I called him and I asked if he would be interested, and he's, of course, John says yes to everything. That's why we love him.
That's why he's here.
And so he said, well, what are you thinking of? And I said, well, I'll leave it to you, but I said, I want it to be a woman. It's always guys, and God love you, but I think we're finally going to take our place, our rightful place. And so I said, just anything. And I said, I have to have this in like 2 weeks, John. So he emailed me maybe 7 hours later with just a beautiful design of a woman on a horse. Very, you know, totally recognizable. And he said, well, you know, what do you think about this? And I was just like, perfect. Say no more.
Okie dokie. Well, hang around. Don't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Bill and Kate Fitzgerald and Donnie Biggins, all from Fitzgerald's, the American Music Festival, Wednesday, July 3rd through Saturday, July 6th at Fitzgerald's. That's 6615 West Roosevelt Road in Berwyn. www.fitzgeraldsnightclub.com. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. Thanks, you guys. And we'll be back with John and Sally after this on WGN.
How many stars are out tonight? How many stars? How many stars? How many stars are out tonight? How many stars? How many stars?
That's the Mekons. From their latest record, Deserted. In the studio, we have Mekons, Sally Timms.
Hello.
And John Langford.
Get off your phone, Sally.
It's the words for the song.
And we've kept Bill and Kate and Donnie in the studio, so because we'll segue into some Fitzgerald stuff and Waco Brothers stuff. But let's start with that song. That's off the new record. And
that's one of the few songs we actually had before we went to make the record. We'd sort of thought about that one a little bit, but we knew we wanted to go and record in the desert in California, in Yucca Valley, near the Joshua Tree National Park. And our new our current bass player, most recent bass player, Dave Trumfio, has a sort of a share in a studio out there in the middle of nowhere. So we went there during a tour and just kind of hung out there and saw what popped out.
And how long were you there, and what was that experience like?
We were there for about 5 days, on and off, but we kept going off to play shows occasionally, so it was the usual Mekon experience, where it's too many things crammed into a very short period of time. But it was really stunningly beautiful, and we would just record in the day, and if we had a show to play nearby, we'd just drive and do it, and then come back and keep recording.
We did Puppy and Harriet's, and then
San Diego, and just, you know, short hops, and then come
and
back.
Drive back.
And all crammed into one house, sleeping in, you know, squeezed together in whatever beds there were.
Well, some people had those
little trailers
pods
that you can see on the front of there. Right. Yeah.
Tom was in one of those. Yeah.
Did you stay in these? These little, like,
yeah, a couple of people did. Yeah. I think Steve didn't like it. He came and slept in my room with me and Eric.
But
I think he was scared of the coyotes.
It was really beautiful. I mean, every morning I would wake up with the dawn and I'd walk outside, and all you could see was the Joshua Tree forest going up to the mountains and the sun coming up over the mountains, and there would never be just me. Everyone else had woken up at the same time. Because you couldn't help but go out and look. It just got you up.
We got up early and we stayed up really late. Yeah.
The stars, I think I read in some background, those weren't necessarily California stars. Were they from Australia? I mean, when the stars in that song.
Partially, it was about that, yeah. I mean, I was in Australia and I was suddenly, you know, out in the outback with some Aboriginal friends. And, you know, you really see the Milky Way there, and it's kind of overwhelming. But the only other place I'd seen it like that was in Joshua Tree.
It was?
Yeah, yeah. It's very... suddenly you realize people were sitting around for thousands and thousands of years, and that was kind of like Netflix. You know, you'd be sitting there looking up at that. I mean, it was so spectacular.
Except better.
I was looking at some stuff. You did, when you did Natural, you recorded that in a cottage in the English. I remember we talked about that back at the old time.
Yeah, we went in very close to, well, it was in the Lake District, so, you know, where Wordsworth roamed around. And we also did a record on the island of Jura when we went to Scotland and toured the Highlands and Islands. Because, you know, the whole thing about the Mekons at this point is it's got to be fun for us. If it's fun for us, then that's okay. And so why would we just carry on doing the standard, you know, going into a studio or playing a regular place all the time? It's got to be something new.
Site specific.
We've got site specific. Yeah, right. That's holiday, vacationing, and working at the same time.
Well, we just saw this spot when we did Natural, and it was lovely. And we saw this pub that was fantastic. And then we thought, oh, this is great around here. We were with the Sadies actually, so we should come back here and do something. And then there was a big stone circle. And then this barn we could just set up in. And it was just amazing. And all the songs became about the immediate landscape and think the history of that area. So
yeah, that's right. You know, this little documentary we've been working on. How long did it take to do the Mekons documentary? About seven?
That was probably 6 or 7 years.
6 or 7 years. That's about where we're at.
Yeah,
but we—that's one thing we try to do is talk about how environment and air and all that influences music. Do you find that when you go to these different locations and make music, how does the environment influence you guys?
Well, I would say lyrically it does. I'm not sure if sonically it does.
I think it did sonically on this, maybe in a kind of like big potpourri of kind of like different influences and associations, but definitely some of the stuff on the Deserted album. There's moments in it. I can't remember playing it. I don't know how it came about, but there's a bit. There's a song, After the Rain, and there's a sequence at the very end of that, at the end of the album, which just it's like a load of kind of squeaking noises, and I can't tell who's playing what.
Uh-huh.
But it's really, for me, it sounds very much of that place.
Yeah, it's very site. Like you said, it's very site specific.
Yeah, odd.
Give the listeners who are maybe not familiar with the band a little history of the band when you guys formed in 77.
Formed in 77, punk rock band. We were described as the people who took punk rock as the furthest extreme, actually forming a band with people, no one who could play whatsoever. And we thought that was a positive advantage. And then slowly over the years, we had some adventures with major labels, and real musicians joined the band, and after a while we weren't afraid of them, because we realized that real musicians are good if they what they play is in service of the song or the collective experience rather than the virtuosity of the music. We were reacting against was the 70s, the prog rock stuff. I mean, we couldn't get, we couldn't have been in now one of those bands.
Now you're back.
So we formed up. Now we've done a prog rock album. So it's gone full circle. This is our, in the court of the Mekong King album, this one.
And you really don't rehearse because you all live in different places.
That's cheating, Dave.
Yeah.
We do rehearse, but we don't. We do rehearse, but we can't rehearse because, some of us live in the States. And we don't even live in the same city in the States. And then some people live in London. Some people sometimes live in Russia. Some people live in Devon. So the only time we get together is when we're playing. So we have like a very, very short period of rehearsal, which we're very used to now.
Which usually gets eaten away by flight delays or people not.
Well, we get by on charm. If you're under duress, you have to be charming.
So. I've run out.
But you have a slew of shows coming up. I'm going to try to get these straight. 9 p.m. July 12th at the Hideout.
Yep.
And then you're at the Square Roots Festival up there by Lincoln Square.
Bloodshot 25th anniversary day.
Yeah, that's on the Saturday. Yeah.
Is that the 13th and 14th? Yeah.
And the 14th, we're back at the Hideout.
Yeah, and then you're even doing a show up in Madison.
Yep. Yeah.
The High Noon Saloon.
With the Wecons.
Who are they?
They're a Mekon
the Mekons band. Tribute band called the Wecons, who we bumped into. And then
probably going to be better than we are.
Yeah. We thought it'd be quite funny. They were quite embarrassed when we asked them to do it. Really? Yeah, why not?
They're unrehearsing right now.
We got to take a break and then maybe we'll come back with a song. I don't know. You're going to sing a couple songs first.
Yeah, right? We're going to do a song. We're going to be bold and do a song off the new album.
Oh, good, good. Yeah. All right, so don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Yum.
And bone dirt dry, tongue teeth, hook round eye, hunkered down in this barren hole, bristling exoskeleton antennae. Come back later, come back.
Come back again.
You should see us after the rain. Armor plated seeds and spores, armor plated desperation, horns and ammo slit and claw, bleached white across desert floor. Come back in 7 years, come back,
come back again,
come back later, come back,
come back again.
You should see us after the rain. Tracks in winter storms of spring, when flood and mud roll in, sleep and wake to germinate, bursting out of the ground. Come back in 7 years, come back,
come back again.
A moment, a thousand years, come back again, come back later,
come back, come back again.
You should see us after the rain.
Now there's some squeaking noises that we can't render here, unfortunately.
Little animals coming to
just
life.
Imagine them.
Bursting out of the ground.
It's After the Rain from
Very
Deserted
cool.
by the Mekons.
Who has to sing the words bristling exoskeleton antenna?
Why don't you speak
me.
Into the microphone?
I am speaking into the microphone. I'm sure it's picking up. It is a microphone.
It's just AM radio. You can't just wander off around
not,
the room.
It's not steam-powered. I'm in the room.
I've interviewed you guys a few times, but did you meet through? How did you guys first meet?
Punk rock.
Was it?
In Leeds, yeah.
Was it Leeds?
Not true, actually.
What?
My cousin, Lizanne, was sharing a dorm with your girlfriend at the time.
No, they were in a, yeah, they weren't in a dorm.
In a halls of residence.
They were in a hall of residence. Yeah.
So.
Dorm.
Yeah.
No, they were not in a dorm. They had single rooms, I seem
well,
to remember.
Well, it's the same. That is what a dorm is.
Carnegie yeah. College of Education.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how I met John.
And what were you doing? What were you studying? What were you doing?
I was studying modern languages and business studies, but I wasn't at the university. I wasn't that smart.
Yeah.
I'm the village.
You were at the
idiot.
Poly with Mark Almond and Green from Scritti Politti
yes.
and Frank Tovey from Fad Gadget. I was at the university with the Gang of Four and the Mekons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
And how many people have gone in and out of the Mekons? Over last time I was over 25.
There might be. Not really as many as you'd think. And
yeah.
the current lineup's been pretty stable since
it's
kind of 85, the very beginning of 85.
It's
Lou
a kind
and Steve
of open
John.
House, so
yeah.
people come and do things and go away. But the core band and even the original core band are still knocking around in whatever form. So I would say it's a pretty stable lineup.
And how many pieces will be at these shows we're talking about?
All eight.
All eight.
The ridiculous number of
yes.
eight.
Yes.
Divided by, everything's divided by eight. Doesn't make any sense.
One of my favorite stories is when you, this is kind of off the track a little bit, when you booked the band into the Mutiny. Do you remember that story?
Yes, I do.
Talk about that. And okay. the Mutiny closed about a year ago.
I know,
right?
It's just closed actually
sad.
More recently.
Really?
It's a real
Describe
loss.
The Mutiny for people who, yeah.
Well, the Mutiny is a bar we used to drive by on Western, right by Fullerton, and they have a big sign that says just bands wanted in the window. And we always thought, what is that place? And I knew that they put on kind of like punk rock shows or various things, but I'd never been in it before. And we wanted to do, we had this idea that we were going to do at the end of the tour, we were going to do a show or a couple of shows that raised money for charity. We did it for Doctors Without Borders. So we had
this. We got them 3 miles of borders.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we did The Hideout. It was called From the Hideout to the Mutiny. So we played at The Hideout, and then we caught the CTA bus with the audience to the Mutiny, and it was,
and some of the equipment.
And the equipment, some of
no,
it.
No, we didn't. We caught it to the corner of North Avenue and West,
and then
we
had to change buses.
And
Tim Tutton and Cynthia Plastercaster were the tour guides on the bus. So we played a show, got on the bus, caught the bus with as many, it was packed with people. And then some people who were just on the bus ended up coming to the show because they were like, well, what are you doing? But the best thing was when I called up to get the gig at the Mutiny, and I called up and I said, okay, we want to play at your club. And this woman, I think it was Rhonda, she went, yeah, okay, well, what kind of music? And I went, well, it's kind of country folk stuff. And she said, well, what's the name of the band? Mekons. Completely nonplussed. She'd never heard of us. So I said, she said, well, you've got to bring in at least 100 people. And I was thinking, yeah, right. And it's like the Mutiny is packed with 100 people every night. So I was like, well, yes, we can do that. And so she went, all right, you're booked. And that was it. She kind of like completely dismissive. It was great. And then I was thinking, well, is it booked really? You know? And so about a month before, I would call up and go, we're still on the calendar, right? She'd go, yeah, you're booked. That's it. You know, that's all it took, nothing else. And then closer to the date, when we started advertising, they clearly were getting like loads and loads of calls going, is this a joke? Are the Mekons really playing at the Mutiny? And they were like, yeah. And so then when I called her, she was always like, what's going on? And so the whole place was just packed when we showed up. It was fantastic. It was really, really a great night.
Paul Birch played from Nashville with his band. And then
and we have
Bonnie Prince Billy was playing.
Yeah, Will Oldham played and Ted Leo sang. Loads of different people came and sang. And it was just a really fantastic evening. And we raised a lot of money.
At the end of the night, the guy wouldn't give us a drink when we walked in. He was suddenly giving me pitchers of margaritas. And at the end, as we were leaving, he came up to me and said, you know, man, that was you're like the second best band that ever played here. And I thought, that's perfect. I think I was meant to ask who's the best band, but I didn't. I just left.
And they had an 8-channel PA, and one of the channels was broken. And it sounds fantastic in that room.
Yeah.
It's like fantastic.
And there was an old bass amp in the corner that no one had plugged in for years, and it was all covered in cobwebs. And then there was a ceiling tile dangling down. And Kelly Hogan saw the ceiling tile dangling down the old bass. She sat on the floor and started crying. She said, this is so beautiful. She had a very emotional moment.
Did you guys ever go there, Bill, Kate?
I've been in there.
It was a total dive.
I've forgotten the name of the guy who runs it, and he was it was fantastic. A great Chicago. We're losing all these places,
and it's not just a
tragedy.
And it's not just a sign in the window. It wasn't like a paper sign. It was painted on the window.
Yeah.
Bands wanted. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, they wanted bands to come.
And it was really egalitarian. I mean, I loved the idea that I just called up and said, I want a show. Okay. Yes. No, like, send me your CD or anything like that. Yeah, all right, you can have a show. As long as you bring 100 people, which I know is clearly not what was going on every single night at the Mutiny. But it was just, you know, they were just great.
I never got around to it. I always wanted to do a story. They had karaoke at 10 in the morning on Saturdays. And they told me one time, I was in there a few times, and they said, like, people would, you know, maybe come in after, you know, for karaoke, they've been out all night.
Yeah.
And they would come in.
I feel bad. And the first time we walked in there was to play the show. And then I think I went back once or twice. But, you know, it just seems to me a great shame that we're losing.
Yeah, you guys have been around a lot. You've been around Chicago. You guys came here about 85, 86, something?
Well, I moved here in 97.
Okay.
I started coming here to
First
play.
Time I came was 85.
Yeah.
The Three Johns, played the Metro.
Yeah. So you've seen the changes.
Yeah, I mean, really, we never ventured. We used to go to El Sol, like on Ashland and Fulham, and think that was like, wow, it's the West Side.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
That was kind of like, we're really exploring the urban environment here, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of new great venues, to be honest. There are, you know, if you go down Milwaukee, there's tons and tons of, if you want to play rock music or you know, if it's...
My kids are out at things all the time. I've got a 17-year-old and a 21-year-old. I mean, for the last 5 or 6 years... I've heard about all these great kind of illegal clubs and warehouse parties and stuff like that.
Do you think they move around the city more than they did in the 80s? In other words, there's more stuff going on in Pilsen maybe than there was in 85. You know?
My kids do. They go all over the place.
I think that just tells you where's gentrifying, really.
Yeah, really? Yeah.
But yeah, clearly people are living all over the city doing whatever they do. You know, we do our thing, other people do their things.
It's like old areas, like, I mean, Lincoln Park was the groovy place when we first came here. You know, up and down Halsted Street and up, you know, around by Diversey. That was kind of ground zero, and it was really cool. And then now, I mean, you know, Wicker Park, which was, and Logan Square are completely kind of neutered. You know, as
places to go.
If you like sports bars.
If you like, you know, Chicago's great if you like loads of sports bars and loads of people in pastel T-shirts and baseball caps. You know.
All right, we could take a break for the news.
He's not wearing a pastel T-shirt.
And we'll be back.
Pastel Fitzgerald's T-shirt.
After this on WGN.
Everybody's so in love, but they don't touch your meat. Eyes are weeping, eyes all red. A bunch of flowers in the street. I love a millionaire. I love a millionaire. I love a millionaire. I love a millionaire. The champagne was never cheap, but I could pay someone to drink it for me and never rise up from these sheets. Watching time just roll away. I love a millionaire. I love a millionaire. I love a millionaire. I love a millionaire. Stretching out my bones. A million miles from home. Well, lust corrodes my body. I've lost count of my lovers, but I can't count my money forever and forever. I love a millionaire. I love a millionaire.
Imagine guitar solo.
That's the greatest hit, I would say.
A snippet.
A snippet.
We don't have any hits.
I know. That's what album is that off of?
That's off an album called I Love the Mekons.
Yes. Yeah, right.
Oh, I Heart Mekons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I Love the Mekons. I know that song.
Yeah. That was our first record for Touch and Go, where we had a happy, safe haven for 15 years in Chicago when we... First moved to Chicago, and our agent said, you should go and talk to Touch and Go, because we've been signed to A&M Records, then we were on Wea Latina, and we were on some other independent label in LA, and it was just a big mess. And we went up to see Corey, and he actually came and met me at Margie's Candies in Bucktown, and we had a handshake and a smile, and 15 years of very productive and safe places for the Mekons.
I've got a guy calling me and bugging me. He's insisting the Beatles never were at Margie's Candies.
I thought there were pictures of them.
Yeah, I know. Well, there's pictures. I don't know if they're at... I've got to go look at that again. It's been about a year and a half or 2 years since I've been there, but can you believe that? How can you, like, screw up an urban legend like that?
I know. I mean, who cares?
Yeah.
They were there.
Yeah.
They were there if we believe it. Yeah, can't we create our own reality?
I might bring him on
anyway.
The show.
What was Margie's name? Margie Poulos?
Yeah, I interviewed her.
Yeah, she wouldn't said have
made,
they were there.
She wouldn't have made that
she
up.
She couldn't. She was a nice Greek lady.
Yeah, right.
She wouldn't have made that up.
Yeah. And she died right in front of that place. Remember that?
Really?
Yeah. There was like an accident. There was like a bus accident or a car accident. She had a heart attack right in front of the store. Yeah. Where did you learn? I talked to you before, but talk about your roots in music. Where did you learn to sing? Was there music around the house, Sally?
Well, I don't come from a musical family, although my parents liked music. I don't know. It's like weird. No one else in my family was a musician, and I didn't think I would be one. I used to sing in the church choir when I was a kid. And I did a lot of poetry recitals, and I think those always kind of factored into being able to deliver stuff. So I was very used to being on a stage when I was a kid, too. But I had no desires to be a musician or even think it was a possibility. And then I met Pete Shelley from the Buzzcocks when I was 18, and we were friends. And I told him about this crazy language that me and my friend Kay had made up and was singing it to him. He said, let's go and record that. And the next day we went in and recorded this whole album of improvised like music of me just singing made up words and a lot of people playing pots and pans. And he put it out and I was like, really? That's how it works? So that was kind of like, you know, the whole idea of punk rock was
Hangar.
And it's still actually one of the...
Do a bit.
It's kind of like that, but
it was
of
weird.
Reverb.
We went, but we went to. It came out and then kind of disappeared, and then we went to Dusseldorf or somewhere like really.
I used to get letters from Belgian jazz musicians who were begging us to go over.
No, they said, "You are Sally Schmidt. You make Hangar."
Yeah.
People were like really.
Or people
you know,
had said,
Teutonic
oh, yeah,
people
I took,
really
I took
liked
loads
it.
Of mushrooms and listened to that for 14 hours. So, you know, it had a life, and I still love that record. And so, I don't know. After that, then I met all the people from the Mekons and the Gang of Four in Leeds, and everyone was in a band. Every single person. So it was just like, let's, you know, be in a band. It doesn't matter if it's good, bad, or indifferent. And I suppose in the end, those of us who had the persistence to keep going are still going.
And you've done solo projects.
I have, yeah.
Do you have anything coming up?
No, I'm too lazy.
You're too lazy?
Yeah. I have a day job. That's enough for me.
But what's it like for you guys, and we'll get into the Waco Brothers, when you get away from this? I mean, when you come back to the Mekons, is, you know, what's it like to create new music with other bands and come back and doing the Mekons and stuff?
I love collaborating, but yeah. The Mekons is a different, very different sort of kettle of fish, if you know what I mean. It only really occurs when we're together, and it's dependent on, I think, that at least being a quorum of the right people there in the right place. And it's everyone's scattered, geographically challenged bands. So, you know, when we get together, then that's when it really exists. And it's almost like it doesn't, you know... The endless email chains, you know, I could take that or leave that. You know, it's kind of boring. But when we're all together, there's obviously a desire by everyone to, you know, be
it's
part of
this. It's a family.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a dysfunctional family.
It that's what it is. So when we get together, it's like very quickly it goes into, you know, that whole family setup.
And I imagine maybe the energy level's a little higher when you haven't seen it. Things, the sparks.
Not really.
Not really?
Energy level.
Depends.
What's that?
We're getting old.
Yeah.
I try and get my energy levels up. I do a lot of the prep work, so
you
my
do.
Energy levels by the time I see them are very low because I hate them all. So
I'd say your energy levels are quite high. We just did a tour in Europe though in April, and it was kind of it was a tough one. We had a new label over them. I think we all felt we should prove ourselves that we're serious about it. So we went and did, you know, like 2 weeks, we're playing every night with 10-hour drives in a van.
We had some crazy drives, like 12.5-hour drives to go and play a show, which is
Copenhagen to Frankfurt.
Not what we used to do when we were young a lot of the time.
No, this was brutal. We'd always have days off, and this we had no days off. And it was, but we all actually came back feeling, I felt really great.
We didn't die.
No. Vans? You tour in vans? I read somewhere you've never had a tour bus?
No.
Yeah.
Can't afford one. Yeah. I mean, we make enough money to keep the band going and get paid when we're playing, but, you know, we play 4 weeks of the year every 2 years, so it's not a living.
I don't like tour buses. I wouldn't want to go on. I find them weird when you go on other people's tour buses.
It's so very controlled. Someone was telling me, I shouldn't say which band it was, so I'm not going to, but they had a tour bus, but because they were playing in small venues, they weren't really a band that... were playing in large venues in Europe, there was nowhere for the tour bus to park, so they would arrive in a city and have to park in a, like, basically the equivalent of Home Depot in the suburbs parking lot and be stuck out there until they played the gig. I thought, what is the point of that?
Yeah.
You know, we get to at least get into a hotel and then we get to roam around the city, and that's the whole thing for us, is the experience of just the cultural thing and the food.
So the Waco Brothers, now I don't know if it was the first time you guys played together. Okay, we're going to take a break. I want to get into, we'll talk about the Waco Brothers and then...
Let's talk about the Waco Brothers.
The gig at Fitzgerald's, but I want... So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. I'm Dave Hochstromer in the studio with a bunch of people. John Langford and Sally Timms talking about the new Mekons record, Deserted, on Bloodshot Records. Thank you.
25th anniversary of Bloodshot.
Thanks for coming in. But we're also talking, I want to talk about, go back to Fitzgerald's, which we talked about a little while ago. The Waco Brothers are playing the first night?
Yeah, the third. Yeah. We play Wednesday night.
Yeah, you guys.
Where are we playing, Bill?
You close the club. You go on.
We close the club.
Yeah, you go on at 11:45 right after J.D. McPherson.
Oh my God, 11:45. What are you thinking?
And Robbie Fulk will be there. We're all staying up. We're all staying up to the end.
Oh.
I'm going to be on the side of the stage watching Alan destroy my monitor again. Well,
I'm going to a party at 7:30 on July the 4th in the morning. So, oh well.
7:30 in the morning?
Yeah, our vet has a party.
Really?
Yeah.
In the morning?
Dr. Mike.
7:30 in the morning?
I go and he's the last medical person I spoke to. He's my vet. I'm going to have a chat with him.
About your own health.
So, again, for listeners who might be listening for the first time, talk about the Waco Brothers. And this goes into what we were talking about, the Mutiny. I don't know if it was your first gig, but the first time I saw you guys was Wrigleyville Tap. That had to be early in your career.
No, that's the first proper gig, because that's the first gig that was called the Waco Brothers.
Yeah.
We'd done like three or four gigs before that with just me and Tracy and Dean Schlabowski. And I think the first one was called John Boy and Dino's Church of Country and Western Music. Then we did one it was terrible, so we thought we'd better change the name so people might come to the next one. So the next one was called Ranch Quake. Then it was called Hillbilly Love Child. And then somebody, Dean, did a poster saying Waco Brothers, and I thought, that's a bit off, isn't it? You know, Waco Brothers. And then Tom Ray and Steve Goulding, who's now in the Mekons.
Yeah.
Came and played with us, and it was like at Jimmy and Ty's, and it was actually like proper music, and people thought we were a real band. And then we started getting off.
I believe Floyd, who just passed away, Floyd Saunders, and he might have introduced
Floyd used
you.
To introduce us.
Yeah,
we played there a few times, and he used to introduce us. Yeah, he was a character.
Ranch Quake, that's pretty good though. That's a good second one. Bill and Kate, what's it like when they come in the club? I mean, you've played a lot at Fitzgerald's. So tell the listeners
several
what to
times.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, it's just so much fun. I love watching you guys from the side of the stage, your front line, when you guys are doing all the jumping
ballet.
Around. Yeah. And then you get to see the audience as well. It's just a great scene to be that close, and it's a lot of fun.
I remember playing one year when Bill was, Bill didn't see our set because he was cooking a turkey directly behind the stage, and the smell was coming into the club. And across the stage, because afterwards we were going to have, what do we have? You had White Castle sliders, uh-huh. And he put turkey and little cranberry sauce, and we call them the gobbler.
Yeah. Birth of the gobbler.
It was an enhanced, slider. Yeah.
It was an enhanced everything.
But we were really distracted when we were playing, because we knew we were going to get this food afterwards, and it was the night before Thanksgiving. But 1 a.m, we just sat around going, nom, nom, gobble, gobble, gobble.
Had all the flavors of Thanksgiving.
He hit all the food groups were there.
Are you listening out there?
Talk about for both John and Sally. I mean, your respect of American country music. I mean, that's kind of what some of the Waco Brothers stuff started with. I mean, at the beginning, people were saying Cash meets Clash and stuff. But
it was the Sundowners.
Yeah,
we came to Chicago, and with somebody we played like the Cubby Bear, and somebody said, "You got to come downtown and see a proper country band and a country and western band," which they were. You know,
yeah.
Sundowners played for 35 years in town. First down at the R&R Ranch down by the Greyhound bus station, then at their own place out on Mannheim Road, the Sundowners Ranch.
Yeah, you know,
they played me and my Helen, who's here. They played our. The day before our wedding in her parents' back garden. Never knew if they were going to come, but they turned up. But at the first night the Mekons went to see him, we'd all been to Alcala's, and we'd all had like ridiculous, only a British rock band would dress like that. Cowboy shirts, Stetsons, bolo ties, everything. So they were like, "Ooh, looks like we got a band here. You guys want to get up and play?" We're like, no, come on up. And we were like, "Oh, really?" And we got up and we played. And it was, to actually play in front of a genuine redneck audience of drunks at 4 a.m. Yeah. We were terrible.
Yeah.
We should have done, I know. But they didn't. People liked it, though, but we were just terrible. And I thought, if I go back there ever, I'm going to have a few songs. So I learned a few Johnny Cash songs. I thought, I want something that I could actually stand with. If they ever call me up again, and then, of course, every time we ever went there, we always got called out, because they wanted a break so they could have a cocktail.
Yeah, right. Those guys knew a lot of songs. And it's in line with what we're talking about. They really didn't have any musical prejudice. I mean, they would do, like, you know, Fats Domino
Something
covers.
Something in the way she moves reacts me like no other lover. Yeah, they did everything. They did everything. They were brilliant. And, you know, they were just lovely guys. We got to know them quite well. And I think there's a bit in the Mekons documentary that Joni Delaney, before she passed away, got interviewed, and the guy was the director was asking her, well, you know, so tell us about how you met the Mekons. Said, well, my husband came home one night from the club, and he said, you never guess what blew in tonight, some punk rockers from England. And Joan says, well, did you make them get up and play? Yeah, of course we did. Were they any good? No. But they're willing to learn. Which is great. You know. Yeah.
Sally, were you there? Did you see all that stuff?
I was there for some of it, I think. I can't really remember. I do remember singing Long Black Veil, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
with
Black.
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. They were sweet guys. So, the gigs. Talk about the gigs again. We've got... The Hideout
sold out.
It sold out 9 p.m. on July 12th. Okay. And then we've got the Square Roots Festival. Talk about that. The 13th and 14th, back to back?
No, we play Square Roots on the 13th.
Okay.
So the Saturday is, and then we're back in the Hideout on the 14th.
Oh, you're back in the Hideout.
Which
on the
14th. Is also sold out. So.
But that's a donation thing, I think, for the Square Roots Fest.
Square Roots is anyone can get in.
And Murder by Death and Vandaliers are playing as well, or Bloodshot Band, so it's a Bloodshot celebration. And then I think the Gold Stars, who are like Andre Williams, old backing band, Ken Goodman and his guys, are going to do, they're putting a kind of Bloodshot Greatest Hits show early in the afternoon, so I'm going to get up, some of the Wacos are going to get up and sing, I'm going to sing a song.
And the Wacos will be at Fitzgerald's?
On the 3rd.
Talk, before we sign off with a song for the new record, talk about the T-shirt. We were talking about that before you came
in. Well, Kate phoned me up and said, I want a T-shirt. And then, will you design something? And this is what it has to be, exactly like this. And then I just did what she said. And it's turned out beautifully. So I'm very good at taking direction.
You are very good at taking direction, shockingly. Yeah.
Came out right there, didn't it?
Oh,
well, we haven't seen one yet. We've got an image of what it might look like.
No, I loved it instantly. I had no notes.
Did you? I heard, maybe you guys told me, did you prank her a little bit? Did you send her some fake ideas at first?
Well, I was sketching, and I sort of... She was talking to me down the phone, and I was sketching. Some of them came out pretty weird, so I said, will this do? You know?
I think I still have those.
Like, what was one? Was there one we could talk about that was really...
They were just line drawings.
Well, strangely deformed, mutant lady. She wanted a woman on it. I was like, all right, we'll have a woman on it. We'll definitely have a woman on it. But these were like no women you've ever seen. So.
And it gave you pause.
just for a moment. Just for a moment, but it was a pause. Yeah.
You like playing? You've played the American Music Festival before.
Yeah, many times.
Yeah, what's it like? Again, talking about family.
Again, that's like a reunion.
Yeah,
as
right.
Because we always see so many people we know and bump into. It's great.
You like the food? Tom Sims food?
I like the food.
Yeah. Mekons, Deserted. The camper, the trailer
album,
on the cover.
Our best album ever.
first studio record in like 8 years, is that right?
No. Not really.
I read that somewhere.
Don't read press releases. Yeah. Fake news.
Yeah. When was the one before this?
Well, we did that one. Well,
Existentialism, which was recorded in a room in theory in one night with an audience, but people say it's a live record, but it wasn't. It was
all new songs.
It was new songs with the audience actually participated. So people paid to come and then they would sing and participate on the recording. So we didn't stop and there was no applause at the end of each song. We didn't even actually engage with them. We had Dave Nagler was the conductor.
The feral choir wrangler.
Yeah, so, you know, the idea was that people would be on the record, and it was a record that was in profit before it was recorded because people.
Yeah, it's the first one we've ever made a profit.
75 people pay $75 to be on the record in the room and all named on the record, and it was like, oh, that's a great idea. And then John had the idea that, well, what, you know, because we were looking at how Third Man do everything, and they do everything so beautifully, but of course they have a much larger audience than we do and more money, but. Said, well, what can we do? And he said, well, maybe we just make this beautiful little golden egg. There's just one of them, and you crack it open, and then there's the download code. But we don't have fans who have that kind of money. So
no,
we
it's
made
50
a book,
grand.
Actually. So we actually
for the
made
one
a book
golden egg.
Book and put the record inside it.
Well, thanks. This is a real treat. It was nice seeing you guys
Thank
again.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to see you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Bill and Kate and Donnie. You want to set up this last song? It's going to be Mirage. It's going to be off Deserted.
Sally should talk about this one.
No, I can't. I don't know what it is.
Mirage. This song just kind of came out of nowhere while we were there. This is one of the ones that was really influenced, I think, by the kind of environment we were in. And Tom had a little guitar part that was very simple, and then it just turned into a bit of a improvisation, and he started singing, and it's sort of echoes of all periods of the Mekons seem to come together in this, and also something kind of scary and ancient as well.
Okay, thank you, Ro, and thank you, Bob Fukuduga, for the engineering, and here's Mirage on WGN.
Celebrate the start of summer with a Super 70s TV flashback.
Far out!
Visits and interviews from Cheryl Ladd to Sydney Williams, Suzanne Summers, and Gavin McLeod. Plus, our friend Dave Schwann takes us on a trip on the Mother Road.
It's a trip for the bucket list. It's Route 66.
Dave Flyer, overnight tonight on 720 WGN.
Win the ultimate White Sox family reunion. Just listen to the Ro Khan Show with Anna DeValente's weekday afternoons at 5:40 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. The news is sponsored by Lindeman Chimney and Fireplace, and here's David Jennings.
We've got a few clouds in 76.